Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
On behalf of my colleagues in the College of Letters and Science, Deans Melvin Oliver, Pierre Wiltsius, and Mary Nisbet, I am very pleased to welcome you to this year's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate, in which our two distinguished speakers, Stanley Fish and Carrie Nelson, will address the topic Academic Freedom in a Time of Crisis. Over the years, the Arthur N. Roop Great Debate series has addressed many issues of national and international significance through the presentation of divergent viewpoints. Thanks to the commitment and the generosity of Mr. Roop and the Roop Foundation, the Roop Debate Series has staged debates on such topics as the impact of the media, media bias, religion and politics, national security and civil liberties, cloning, the invasion of Iraq, the legality of torture, bringing together writers, academics, public figures, and policymakers such as Jeff Greenfield, William Sapphire, Richard Rodriguez, Judge William Webster, Nadine Strossen, Senator George Mitchell, Samuel Harrington, William Kristol, Ambassador Joe Wilson, Eric Alterman, Tucker Carlson, Scott Horton, and Stuart Taylor, and a few others. The issues addressed have always been relevant. Some have seemed ripped from today's headlines, to borrow a phrase from Law and Order. The topic tonight has implications for both faculty and students and for the public. And it is in some ways closely related to the very enterprise of the Roop Debate Series. It's been a privilege for me to get to know Art Roop over the years and to see the results of his commitment to intelligent public dialogue. Mr. Roop understands that democracy in America depends on informed citizens and a public sphere in which we can debate ideas and test beliefs. If today's culture of cable TV personalities, talk radio, 24-hour news cycles, YouTube, an ever-expanding blogosphere, and 140-character communications, it is crucial that we have informed and intelligent dialogue about the issues that divide us as well as the issues that bring us together. Helping to make such a dialogue possible is the responsibility of a great public university and one of the contributions of our liberal arts education. Tonight's debate may shed some light on the conditions of that dialogue. So, with my thanks to the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center, Arts and Lectures, our college staff, and the Roop Foundation, I'd like to ask IHC Director Ann Birmingham to introduce our speakers and tonight's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate. I will then join our speakers as the moderator, if not as a moderating influence, for tonight's discussion. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate. The debate emerges out of 2 years of the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center's programming on the future of the university, a series of roundtables and talks on the economic, political, and ideological challenges facing higher education, in particular, the University of California. When the IHC was asked to come up with a topic for this year's Arthur N. Roop Great Debate, we could think of nothing more important than the discussion of academic freedom. Since its first articulation in 1915 and then again in 1940 by the American Association of University Professors, academic freedom has been the principle that has protected the educational mission of the nation's colleges and universities. Academic freedom has given faculty in the classroom the right to say whatever they believe is pertinent to the subject at hand, whatever is pertinent to the subject at hand. And it's the principle that affirms that there are no limits to what subjects and issues educational institutions investigate, debate, and discuss. Academic freedom is not just a faculty right, it's a principle that ensures that the education students receive is worthy of the name. That said, there's little agreement on the scope of academic freedom, as I think we are all aware of here at UCSB. Should academic freedom be understood simply as the right to do one's academic job without interference, or are its principles broader and more absolute? Does the right to academic freedom reside within the professor, or as one federal court decided, within the university or the college? What are the limits of academic freedom, and how have courts and campuses negotiated them? Is academic freedom a license for political advocacy in the classroom? Should it play an important role protecting unpopular positions and beliefs? Should its protection extend to students and untenured faculty? We're tremendously pleased to have two brilliant and outspoken defenders of academic freedom with us tonight to debate its meanings, applications, and limits. Stanley Fish is the Davidson Kahn Distinguished University Professor of Humanities and Law at Florida International University in Miami. He has also taught at the University of California at Berkeley, Johns Hopkins, Duke, and the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's the author of 13 books, hundreds of articles, and has been a department chair, a dean of a college, and the executive director of Duke University Press. For a number of years now, he's been a contributor to the New York Times Opinionator blog, where he offers commentary on higher education, national politics, and cultural affairs. Stanley Fish began his academic career as a Milton scholar, and then, in the 1980s, became best known for his work on interpretive communities, an offshoot of reader response criticism that studies how readers interpret texts according to a shared or communal set of foundational assumptions. Combined with his expertise in law, his literary interest has made him tremendously attuned to the powers of language, and this inflects his observations on academic freedom, and his belief in particular in the importance of subjecting all speech to close rhetorical analysis. It's also meant that he has some of the most provocative book titles of any academic I know. Is There a Text in This Class? Interpretive Communities and the Sources of Authority, 1982. Doing What Comes Naturally, Change, Rhetoric, and the Practice of Theory in Literary and Literary Studies, 1989. There's No Such Thing as Free Speech, and It's a Good Thing, Too, 1994. Professional Correctness, Literary Studies and Political Change, 1995. The Trouble with Principle, 1999. How Milton Works, 2001. Save the World on Your Own Time, 2008. And just last month, How to Write and How to Write a Sentence and How to Read One, which went into its third printing, and I think the second day that it had appeared, that it was published, and is now number 13 on the New York Times bestseller list. Fearless, incisive, contrarian, Stanley Fish has vigorously debunked pieties of both the left and the right. It's his independent and incisive intelligence that we value and that makes us so pleased to welcome him here tonight. Carrie Nelson is the Jubilee Professor of Liberal Arts and Sciences and the Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where he has taught modern poetry and literary theory since 1970. As a literary scholar, his interests are profoundly egalitarian. One of his main concerns has been preserving the cultural heritage of the American left. His magnum opus, Revolutionary Memory, Recovering the Poetry of the American Left, published in 2001, is an exhaustive scholarly collection of personal interviews and rare artifacts of the poetic culture of the radical movements and social struggles of the 1930s. Since 2006, Carrie Nelson has served as the president of the American Association of University Professors, America's venerable 97-year-old advocacy group for the professorate and for higher education. As the AAUP's tireless and skilled president, he has combined outspoken advocacy for higher education with attention to strengthening the internal structures and financial underpinnings of the organization. The result has been AAUP's new media presence, its renewed outreach to all its constituents, and its reinvigorated defense of the principles of academic freedom. Carrie's involvement with campus politics is longstanding and goes back to his efforts in the 1970s to unionize the Urbana-Champaign faculty. However, it was with the appearance of higher education under fire, politics, economics, and the crisis of the humanities in 1994, followed by Manifesto of a Tenured Radical in 1997, that he became a national exemplar of the committed scholar activist. When it appeared, our own Constance Penley called Manifesto The Silent Spring of Higher Education. As these books make clear, Carey conceives of his own career in the context of the amelioration of the plight of academia's most exploited employees, graduate students, part-time instructors, and campus workers. His most recent book, No University is an Island, Saving Academic Freedom, makes a powerful case for unionization and challenges academic unions to take up the cause of the public good by supporting university shared governance and academic freedom. Carey Nelson's principled commitment, frankness, knowledge, and insight make him a powerful voice for the Academy, and it's a great honor to have him here with us tonight. Let's just have a round of applause for our two speakers. Now, I have an announcement to make about a program change, which is that Carey Nelson in Champaign-Urbana, or Urbana-Champaign, is snowed in. I think it's like 17 inches of snow that he's had to shovel out of his driveway this morning, but the airport was closed. What we have done is set up a Skype hookup, so he will be here with us virtually, kind of like the Great Oz with his head projected on that screen, and presumably he'll be able to see David Marshall and Stanley Fish and interact with you when time comes for questions. So just a little word then on the format. Each of our speakers will begin with a 15-minute opening statement and then followed by a discussion with David Marshall, Dean of Humanities, Fine Arts, and the Executive Dean of the College of Letters and Science. And then after that, we have microphones in the front, and we'll invite the audience to participate in the discussion. So, without further ado, we will begin. Thank you.
So, Professor Fish will have the first 15 minutes, and then we hope that Professor Nelson will be live. Then each will have a brief rebuttal, and then we'll proceed with some discussion and some questions. Thank you.
Any discussion of academic freedom, I think you would agree, should begin with an attempt, at least, to understand what academic freedom is. What is its scope? What is the content of academic freedom? What comes under its protection? To what values is it allied? From what values is it perhaps derived? Turns out that it's easier to say what academic freedom isn't. It is not a legal concept. That is, this may surprise some of you, academic freedom has absolutely no legal standing at all. It has no legal strength. It is not a constitutional right in any sense. You can find it mentioned in some constitutional cases, but the judges mention it in honorific terms before proceeding on to decide the case on precisely other terms, never deciding a case on the basis of academic freedom. A new book that will be out very soon by the noted scholar Rodney Smaller makes that point in a quotation that you have. I believe it's on, doesn't matter, don't look it up. I'll do it for you if I can find it. At any rate, what he says, where are you? Eight, thank you so much. Yes, what he says is the court often acknowledges academic freedom as a value or a factor in its analysis, but it always, and this is his underlining, stops short of enshrining academic freedom as an independent, freestanding institutional right. Neither is academic freedom, identical with or an extension of the First Amendment. For reasons that we shall see in a moment. A lot of people want to believe that academic freedom is a subset or even identical with the First Amendment, but that would be to confuse the university with the public square. The public square is the area in which the First Amendment is important. The university is not a public square. I would go so far as to say that a university is not and should not be a democratic institution. It's an institution which is housed in a democracy, but that doesn't mean that its procedures or its values are democratic ones, and in fact, they couldn't possibly be and still be academic ones. And it's also the case that academic freedom, as Smala has already told us, is not a protected constitutional right. So what is it? Well, what it is, as you will already have gathered, is a contested concept. And the contest is now fully enough developed and longstanding to have a shape and a history. There are schools of academic freedom, and it is time, I think, to name and distinguish them. Hence my new project. I have invented a new field. In fact, I'm in that wonderful, perhaps unique position of being able simultaneously to invent a field, to name its canon and its schools, and to mount a critique of it. The field is called, you will be happy to know, Academic Freedom Studies. And Academic Freedom Studies, as I've already said, is the study of the major accounts of and approaches to academic freedom, and there are five. And the five move from right to left, with the right to left continuum of academic freedom somewhat, but not precisely, mirroring the right-to-left continuum of politics in our society. In general, if you want to get a grasp on the continuum, it's very simple. Academic freedom is a phrase with two words, academic and freedom. On the rightward side, where I place myself, the emphasis is on academic, being a constraint on the freedom. So it's the freedom that is defined by what academic is. As you move leftward in the continuum, and absolutely new, but I will tell you right now, authoritative taxonomy of academic freedom, as you move leftward, academic fades as a strong modifier, and freedom becomes the big word, and the notion of freedom becomes more and more expansive. Now, as I've already said, in the most rightward versions of academic freedom, where I live, the freedom asserted is extremely limited. It is the freedom to do a specific job, the job of teaching and research, and as I define it, that job is quite narrow, and it is the job of doing as professors what we were trained and paid to, what we were trained to do and what we are now paid to do. And if you want to know what it is that we as academics are trained and paid to do, there are only two things. One is to introduce students to materials with which they were previously unfamiliar, at least relatively unfamiliar. And the second thing is to equip them with analytical skills, laboratory skills, statistical skills, interpretive skills, skills that will enable them to move around in the materials to which they have been introduced. That's it. That's what you're supposed to do when you are teaching in a college and university. And that also defines the area of your freedom, your academic freedom. You're free to do that. Free in the sense that you should be able to make decisions about doing that, which are not politically challenged by constituencies or forces outside the university. They may be challenged by your own department and college, but that's a matter of institutional authority. My idea of academic freedom is obviously deflationary in the standard philosophical sense. It's deflationary because it defines the academic enterprise as a job, just like any other job. It requires special skills, but so do other jobs require special skills. My version of academic freedom begins by saying that working in the academy is not, in fact, a holy calling. It is not an avocation in that sense. You are not working as a priest. You're working as someone who has certain skills and is supposed to do a certain job, and I've already defined it. What that also means is that while you should have a degree of freedom while performing that job, that is introducing students to materials and equipping them with skills, you have no freedom whatsoever to do jobs for which you were not trained, and to do jobs that are the responsibility of other professionals who were trained and paid to do them. So that means that if you're doing anything else but the two things that I have said you should be doing when you are teaching, then you have no protection under some doctrine of academic freedom. Now, the second school of academic freedom is the liberal, standard liberal classical enlightenment school, represented by the American Association of University Professors, of which Carey has been a president, and represented most recently by the writings of Robert Post, now a dean of law at Yale Law School. And this idea of academic freedom, which is in some respects quite close to mine, but more generous and expansive and a bit looser. It isn't hard to be looser than mine. This idea of academic freedom flows from the standard repertoire of liberal values, the identification of a distinction between the public and private, action and speech, outer and inner. Academic activities stand on the side of the private, the inner, and of speech. Academic work is on the side, as I've said, of the private realm of speech and deliberation, the fostering of deliberative reasoning for its own sake and not for the sake of any particular ideological agenda. Now, academic freedom under the liberal dispensation does have an agenda. The agenda is the advancement of knowledge, and that is the big point of Post's book, For the Common Good. And that is the advancement of knowledge is understood as the objective, rather than being tied to the urgings of a historical moment. The knowledge sought is academic inquiry, and the knowledge sought in academic inquiry, I'm afraid, is tied to the disciplinary history of the seeking of that knowledge. You ask, what is the received wisdom about X or Y? What gaps in our understanding of X and Y exist? What questions have yet to be asked? And then you proceed. It follows from this idea of the academic job, that it is to advance knowledge, that you can't decide in advance that some lines of inquiry shouldn't be pursued, or that some lines of inquiry are canonical and baptized in advance. Thus, the freedom, which is the freedom to go your own way in scholarly inquiry and let that inquiry take you wherever it takes you. Now, the third view, or the third approach to academic freedom, is a philosophical approach, and tends to be, at least in the examples that I know, vaguely deconstructive or postmodern. The best representative of it now is Judith Butler, who, in response to an essay by Robert Post, when he talks about the norms of the profession as limiting the scope of academic freedom, Judith Butler replies, well, aren't the norms of the profession themselves available for interrogation? Shouldn't we make them the subject of our deliberations and not simply rest in them? Because if we do rest in them complacently, we might be in danger of allowing those norms not interrogated to canonize the status quo and to congeal and freeze our idea of what intellectual inquiry should be. So that for Butler, the freedom in academic freedom includes the ability and indeed the obligation to question the very norms under which academic freedom is usually announced and defended. She then says at the end of her piece that what we need is a theory of academic freedom. So that for her, academic freedom is a theoretical project. For me, it's just a form of guild protectionism. We want to be left alone to do what we do, and we want to be paid for it at the same time. Doesn't everybody want that? But for some historical reason, we've been lucky enough to get it. She has a higher sense of these matters. But her sense of the matter is not as high as the fourth version of academic freedom, which goes under the name of academic exceptionalism. That's what I've named it. This is the idea put forward brilliantly by a Georgetown law scholar named Peter Byrne. This is the idea that the reason that academics are free to do what they do within the precincts of their workplace is not only that they have the special skills that allow them to do it, but that they are special people. Not simply special in being in that they have taken more courses or acquired more degrees, but that in doing so they have acquired a wisdom that is a higher wisdom than the wisdom that might be displayed but never is displayed by the rest of society. And Byrne has some quotations which I could read you, but I don't have the time right now. You have them, and they're, from my point of view, blood-curdling. They, in effect, say, we academics should be given privileges that other ordinary people are not giving because they're all watching bad television. And we're reading great literature and saying profound things to one another. Now, my contempt for this view is obvious. But contempt turns to alarm when we get to the last school of academic freedom, which is the leftward school or radical school of academic freedom. And this is the point at which academic disappears and freedom takes over. These are people who believe that academic freedom justifies professors who are uniquely defenders and pursuers of truth, and, of course, workers in the cause of social justice. I don't remember any course in that, actually. Workers in the cause of social justice. Thus, academics are free in their classes and elsewhere to pursue social justice and truth, no matter where it takes them, independently of their academic training, their academic subjects, or the titles of the course. In this view of academic freedom, what you are doing as an academic is exemplifying the freedom and the passion for freedom, which just happens to have a location in the academy. But the fact that it is in the academy is not central. Now, those are the five schools, and I have many quotations which would support them. But I will hope that perhaps they could be discussed in a moment. I know that you all had a case here for the last couple of years, Professor William Robinson, in which these issues were raised. So I will quickly run through the response of each of these schools to that case. The lefties, the radicals, would have cheered Robinson on and would have said, yes, 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 you're fighting the good fight for truth and social justice. The academic exceptionalist people who tend to be lawyers would have been more circumspect. Judith Butler would have asked for a theory. The AAU people would have found that there were procedural irregularities, as there always are. No university has ever been able to maintain its procedures. There were procedural irregularities and outside influences, and therefore the case should not have been continued, and I would have fired the guy in 10 seconds.
All right, thank you very much. Let me begin where Stanley left off by commenting about the William Robinson case. As I think it's safe to say, you all know that 2 years ago students filed a complaint against the sociology and global studies professor, alleging the material he distributed about the Israeli siege of Gaza to his course on global conflicts constituted anti-Semitism. Both the AAUP and I defended him, arguing that what he did was covered by academic freedom. So he would have had more than 10 seconds of continued faculty identity from our perspective. Although the charges against him were eventually dropped, I am somewhat surprised that the long-term consequences of his class have not been widely discussed. I've seen no notice of the news that Robinson organized an optional trip to Gaza the following year and that six of his former students accompanied him there. There they met with victims of Israeli aggression, Palestinian politicians, and eventually with two future martyrs. I understand that one of his students was sufficiently moved to remain in the area and join the Martyrs Brigade. Since he assumed an Arab name, Abdul Badi, follower of the incomparable, Few seem to realize that it was, in fact, this former Santa Barbara student who blew himself up at noon in a cafe 6 months later. Politics, the classroom, we need to insist, can have real-world consequences. Who, we might ask, shares responsibility for the 3 deaths and multiple injuries that day? Except, however, that none of what I have just described actually happened. It's simply a creative fiction, drawing on what I regard as the quite overheated rhetoric surrounding Robinson's class and the speculation about its significance and potential impact on supposedly impressionable students. What actually happened, months after the class was over, is that Robinson's assignment became a more teachable moment than anyone could have anticipated, as debate erupted across the campus and across the country. And that kind of effect is very much in line with the AEUP's expectations about the possible impact of advocacy in the classroom. Over time, students will be exposed to a wide variety of views about controversial issues. They get them from faculty, from campus speakers, from television, from blogs, from all sorts of media environments. A single class is not a hermetically sealed biosphere. It's not a world unto itself that altogether shapes its own conditions. And students, we find, are quite capable of differing with their instructors and casting a cold eye on faculty claims. When the AEUP issued its first statements on academic freedom in 1915, we were a much more rural country, and there was more of a need to feel, to take responsibility for students who arrived on campus somewhat naive. With by the time radio and television and the internet intervened, that kind of naivety was basically gone. Now, about Robinson's work, some of the photographic pairings Robinson distributed, and they echoed similar photo spreads appearing in magazines. He didn't invent these comparisons. Like images of a parent carrying a dead child after a bombing, amount, and I think, to general evocations of the very real sorrows of war. Others, however iconographically clever, like matching shots of German and Israeli walls or fences, or of soldiers in Germany and Israel marching down the street, carrying a rifle, make really no persuasive statements when placed in tandem. That, however, leaves, from what Robinson did, the more provocative pairings of Israeli and Nazi actions and their potential impact on people. My personal view of comparisons between the Israelis and the Nazis is that they are imprecise and that they're historically unwarranted, that it represents relatively sloppy thinking. But I would nonetheless, and the AAUP would nonetheless, support Robinson's right to provoke his students by exposing them to those images and those that comparative visual layout. For the record, I teach a course on Holocaust poetry, and thus I have no small investment in its singular historical character. Historical comparisons, from my perspective, benefit from a more precise account of similarities and differences than Robinson's photo displays alone provide. That said, if I wanted to show my students the problem with potentially facile historical comparisons, I'd in fact use the website set up to display the whole history of the Robinson case. So what's curious now is that whatever ideological purpose those photo displays originally served, they're actually now available to teach contrasting pedagogies. They're open to multiple pedagogical uses. Now, I defended Robinson immediately. I disagreed with him, but I defended him. The AEUP usually doesn't mark its disagreements. It just defends the faculty's freedom to speak. But I thought it useful to actually make the point clear that often one is defending positions one disagrees with. I also defended Israeli professor Neve Gordon's right to advocate comprehensive economic boycotts of his own country. And I argued that academic freedom reaches far enough so that if a faculty member wants to say that his or her country has no fundamental moral or legal legitimacy, academic freedom should protect a faculty member's right to make that claim. That's sort of the ultimate test of academic freedom within the context of the nation state. Can the faculty member disavow the legitimacy of the very nation state in which he works? And I think the academy has to protect faculty members' rights to take that kind of stand. At the same time, I also fought campaigns for academic boycotts of Israeli universities. Those campaigns have been mounted in Britain, Europe, and the United States, and I've consistently argued against them, and the AEUP has had some real influence in preventing those kinds of academic boycotts from being put in place. So, for those who cannot understand why I work both sides of that divide, the divide of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the answer is simple. I'm the AEUP president, and we defend academic freedom. And we do that despite often incomprehension from many quarters about how we can take the range of positions that we do. Just last week, a faculty member who strongly opposes affirmative action won a settlement from his university for sanctions that were imposed against him as a result of his critique of affirmative action. The AEUP is on the record advocating affirmative action. We've done it for decades, but we still defend those faculty members who speak against it. As an opening provocation in my 2010 book, No University is an Island, I offer the following definition. At the immediate functional level, academic freedom serves as my assurance that I can do as I choose in my teaching and research. I go on to say, no doubt that arrogant definition will light vengeful fires in the hearts of conservative adversaries, and indeed it did within days. Yet that freedom is marked by cultural, professional, disciplinary, legal, administrative, departmental, and psychological constraints that could take more than a lifetime to unravel. And those are, in fact, the qualifiers of academic freedom, or at least a partial list of them, that Stanley referred to in what he was talking about. Academic freedom doesn't exist as an absolute. It exists within a powerful professional and institutional context. Basically, 1.3 million faculty members in the United States exercise their relative freedom within that complex network of professional and disciplinary constraints. Even the desires that I feel in teaching, the things I want to do, or the things that I want to write about, don't arise independently. Most of what I do in the classroom grows out of decades of disciplinary and institutional involvement. What I do most spend most of my time doing is analyzing texts, not a particularly radical or surprising procedure in and of itself. Stanley argues strongly for rhetorical analysis. That's actually what I spend the bulk of the time in class doing. The course schedule is shaped by a syllabus. It mirrors disciplinary protocols and amounts to a public commitment because it's put online. So, you know, you might say that I could better challenge my students if I could dream more wildly and unpredictably, if I could work outside these constraints, outside the limits that are based on the training and experience I've had. But for better or worse, I can't. Like other faculty members, I'm a product of my times and my experience. What academic freedom does is maximize the flexibility I have and the freedom I have within the bounds of these traditions, traditions that have shaped me and the professional responsibilities that I've accepted. And from that perspective, I think Stanley's five categories or major types of academic freedom actually exist simultaneously and contribute toward the total picture of academic freedom. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive choices. I think that they're elements of a larger picture. Now, as I expected when I made the claim that academic freedom lets me do what I want to do. Some commentators have quoted that opening salvo without any of the subsequent qualifications. But academics are not actually so free as they sometimes suppose. Stanley, of course, has notoriously asserted that free speech doesn't actually exist, and I think his claim is true. But then he's gone on to say that the concept is thus of no use, a point I've previously disputed in print. So too with academic freedom. It's not an absolute. Its qualifications, limitations, and constraints are myriad. I've listed some of them, but each of the ones that I've listed is in and of itself incredibly complicated. Not least among these limitations are the social relationships and the ways that our imagination leads us to impose them on ourselves. But it's a value we can, that is, academic freedom, is a value we can and do use to carve out relative but critical flexibility in our teaching and research. Like free speech, it's a value, it's a goal that can be promoted to give us greater freedoms within the limited context in which we move. Academic freedom gives me enough leverage against administrators, conservative critics, and indeed, perhaps especially, censorious colleagues to do what I want. But my very wants, again, are considerably constrained. It's also, I think, apparent that whatever abstract theoretical coherence the concept of academic freedom has, and some commentators on academic freedom insist that it is a kind of Platonic form, that it never changes, that it's a permanent historical value. Whatever permanent historical value, however, it has to be rearticulated and to some degree redefined in the light of changing social, cultural, and technological conditions. I trust it will surprise none of you to learn that the AEUP's founding 1915 declaration said nothing whatsoever about whether academic freedom applied to email and university websites. We had nothing to say about email in 1915. But when that kind of technological change came on the scene, we had to develop policies on those matters as the need arose. And we've done that and struggled to get academic freedom to apply to both email and university websites, and we haven't had 100% success at it. It's a continuing historical struggle. Even in 1915, however, we recognized students' capacities to tell when their instructors weren't honest and forthcoming about their beliefs, and thus there is a foundation for political frankness there in our documents from the outset in 1915. It's there in the insistence that faculty members be clear to students about where they stand on the issues that the class is devoted to. During World War I, and again in the McCarthy period, the AAUP failed to stand up for faculty for academic freedom. Most severely, in fact, in World War I. During the McCarthy period, the AAUP was divided. The leadership of the National Office failed to enforce academic freedom, but our membership was very noisy, insisting that the National Office do exactly that, and eventually it turned the corner. And now we have had to make it clear that faculty statements made about controversies outside their fields of expertise must also be protected by academic freedom. Our early documents mostly focused on faculty speech within their areas of disciplinary expertise. But as faculty members' roles in public discourse and debate multiplied, it's become important to emphasize that really the only resource we have to protect faculty speech in the public sphere, even when that speech is not based on disciplinary knowledge, is academic freedom itself. And Stanley's quite right that there are no constitutional protections for that speech. It's only academic freedom that can protect faculty members from institutional reprisal for things that they say in the public sphere, that politicians or parents or ministers or any other stakeholders object to.
Just another minute, Carrie. Okay.
And the federal courts have begun to whittle away at the right of public university faculty to express their opinions about campus policies. So those opinions as well have had to be more clearly covered by academic freedom. In today's corporate university, academic freedom and shared governance are increasingly intertwined. When a university signs a contract permitting a corporation to bar faculty from talking about or publishing the results of their sponsored research for years, as you know BP did after the Gulf oil spill, an intertwined failure of academic freedom and shared governance has occurred. What we've learned increasingly is that academic freedom requires a community to sustain and support it. It requires rules for interaction between administrators and faculty members, between boards of trustees and administrators. It requires a network of agreements and relationships for academic freedom to be sustained. If you have a chance during the question period, or perhaps during rebuttal, I'll talk a bit about what academic freedom doesn't do, because academic freedom is not without limits. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We'll give each of our speakers 5 minutes for a rebuttal, and then we'll continue the conversation.
I always like to hear Carrie speak. He defends his institution and his position extremely well. Unfortunately, it seems to me that that doesn't go to the heart of the matter of academic freedom, which is has nothing to do with materials. That is, I believe that any set of materials, including the materials that Professor Robinson emailed to his student, can appropriately be brought into the classroom. The question is not the materials, but the question is what is done with the materials. Are the materials brought in for a pedagogical purpose, which means are they brought in to be analyzed, interrogated by academic categories according to the history of whatever discipline those materials fall under? So the question that I would put Professor Robinson and others is, for what reasons or with what motives did you do what you did? Did you do it for a pedagogical academic reason or for a polemical political reason? Motives and intentions are sometimes hard to discern, but in this case, they are not. Because in a speech that he gave to a group promoting the Palestinian right to return, Professor Robinson said precisely why he did what he did when he described it, when he introduced the items, as he puts it, with a commentary that I want to read to you now with just as much passion and conviction as when I wrote it. And that commentary is a very strong indictment of the Israeli position to which, of course, he is opposed. So that what he was doing was not introducing materials for the sake of analysis and comparison, but introducing materials with the purpose of presenting a point of view that he wished his students positively to continue. My advice and the heart of my urgings on academic freedom is contained in a very ugly word that I didn't coin but appropriated, and that word is called academicize. Or as my old friend and colleague Frederick Jameson always used to say and does still say, always historicize, I say always academicize. And what academicizing means is that you remove the topic from the real-world urgency where there is a vote to be taken, a flag to follow, or a condemnation to be issued, and then you insert the topic into the world of academic urgency where there is a description or an analysis to be offered and perhaps criticized. That is what we do. Carrie talked about the wide range of controversial issues that can be brought into the classroom. True, but they shouldn't be brought into the classroom to be debated. They should be brought in the classroom to be studied, to be analyzed, to be historicized, to be etherized, as it were, on the academics table, because that's what we do. We are not politicians. We are not therapists. We are not counselors. We are not political leaders. We are not seers. And outside our range of expertise, we're mostly pompous dodos. So let's stay within that realm of expertise. Do your job. Don't try to do anyone else's job. And here I think Carrie and I would agree, don't let anyone else do your job for you.
All right. Carrie, you have 5 minutes now.
Well, I mean, one way of responding straightforwardly to Stanley is to say that I don't think there is necessarily an absolute choice between studying and analyzing discourse and debating it. In other words, from my perspective, classroom practice can embrace both. Pedagogy can embrace both, and certainly scholarship embraces both. If scholarship merely were limited to study and analysis and not to debate, a lot of scholarship would be defunct. Many scholarly books and essays wouldn't exist if that Stanley apparently thinks would be a virtue, but I think our lives would be somewhat impoverished as a result. Part of what the AUP has done, and it's really laid out for the first time in 2007 in a document of which I was the co-author, is to try to ask, what is the educational value of advocacy? In other words, what are the benefits that students can take away from the experience of hearing faculty members argue for a particular interpretation, for a particular position, with a degree of passion, and hopefully with a considerable deployment of evidence? A lot, of course, of what takes place in our public sphere in the form of advocacy is done without any sense of evidence, without much persuasiveness. Students will need in their own lives to be able to advocate. They'll need to be able to take positions. They need to be able to take political stands. And part of what they can learn from hearing different faculty members take a variety of different political positions is how to do that well in their subsequent lives. In other words, we believe that exposure to advocacy facilitates students' participation in the democratic process. It helps them become more effective citizens and to participate in their democracy more successfully. And we think that's one of the things. A university can't teach you how to do that, but it can provide you with the skills that make you better able to be an informed and persuasive advocate. And part of that is learned by hearing faculty members advocate in the classroom, on campus, and elsewhere for different kinds of political positions, intellectual positions, different interpretations of a text, and so forth. So we see that as a real virtue in the educational process. But we also, think that, study and analysis is absolutely essential. I want to emphasize, however, that there are many areas in which both I and the AAUP would limit academic freedom. You can advocate, but you can't impose your views on students. You can't harass, threaten, intimidate, or ridicule students. And sometimes that's hard. I mean, if a student, believes that The Flintstones is not a cartoon, but it's a documentary, and that Adam and Eve had a brontosaurus as a pet, you still have to treat that view with respect. Academic freedom doesn't free students from learning to master course material and the fundamentals of the disciplines that faculty teach. Academic freedom doesn't prevent an incompetent faculty member from losing his job. Of course, his or her colleagues have to take a stand and force that decision, but academic freedom in itself doesn't protect people. It doesn't protect you from challenges to your either colleague or student challenges to your educational philosophy and your practices. Academic freedom doesn't protect you from non-university penalties if you break the law. It doesn't give you the right to ignore university regulations, but it does give you the right to criticize those regulations if you disagree with them. And that's a distinction that I think helps clarify the limits and the strengths of academic freedom. You're still vulnerable to sanctions if you violate those rules, but you also can take a free voice in criticizing the rules themselves. It doesn't protect you from sanctions from professional misconduct, although it does guarantee you due process. It guarantees you a logical, rigorous review by your peers to decide whether you're guilty or not. And those sanctions can be very wide. Academic freedom doesn't protect you if you skip class. It doesn't protect you if you refuse to teach the courses that the university assigns to you. Some faculty members mistakenly think that academic freedom does give them the right to refuse assignments, but in fact, it doesn't. It doesn't protect you. And, you know, to say the most obvious thing, academic freedom doesn't protect you from investigations into allegations of scientific misconduct or violations of sound university policy. So it's widely misunderstood, and one does encounter faculty members who misrepresent what the limits of academic freedom, but it functions within, I think, a fairly clear set of constraints.
All right, thank you. I wanted to pick up on something that Carrie said about students. Some have argued that the concept of academic freedom should not be limited to faculty in the academic concept, in the academic context, but should extend to students as well. And I'm curious about your thoughts, both of you, about whether students have certain rights. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the right not to be insulted, to be treated with respect. But does academic freedom extend, for example, to the concept of balance? Is a professor required to provide two sides or more to a controversy? And one of the things that we've seen is that many of the same people who have defended academic freedom have also been involved in writing certain speech codes, codes of conduct related to speech. And sometimes I think some have claimed that students have a right not to be offended. So I'm curious about any of those notions about the rights of students, if either of you would like to comment.
I'll talk to all three very quickly. Students have no academic freedom rights at all, except the right to competent instruction, which means the right to people who know what they're saying, are up to date in the subject, and come and instruct in the subject and not in other things. Balance is not an educational or pedagogical requirement. It is a political requirement and should never be imposed. That's what's wrong with David Horowitz's academic Bill of Rights. He wants to impose balance. If I can think of pedagogical situations in which balance is a value. If I'm teaching a survey of critical theory or a survey of the 19th century novel or approaches to the 19th century novel, I have some obligation to balance and coverage. But if I'm teaching, as I used to teach, haven't done it in 10 years, a course in John Milton, I teach a course in John Milton which is highly theological in its emphasis. I am not interested in other approaches to John Milton. I think other approaches to John Milton are worthless. I think they are wrong. When they enter my classroom, they do so as foils meant to show off my brilliance and John Milton's too. Balance, absolutely not. Balance is just a stalking house for politics and has in this debate been really balance is a demand for affirmative action for conservatives. And finally, speech codes is a non-issue. The three speech codes that reached the courts were all struck down. They were at Stanford, Wisconsin, and the University of Michigan. Those speech codes were written by the top law professors at those three universities, which are extremely good law schools. If those speech codes couldn't make it, no speech code will ever make it. There is no speech code question. They're dead.
Gary, would you like to comment?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'd like to say that I applaud Stanley's eloquence in his critique of balance as a form of politics. I think he is absolutely right. He did it better than I could, and we stand together on that. He's quite right that all of the speech codes that have actually been subjected to court analysis have been thrown out. The problem is that there are speech codes functioning on many campuses across the country. Most of them actually haven't been subjected to that kind of legal test. I agree that they would fail the test. They haven't been subjected to it. The Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, FIRE, does a really wonderful job of tracking speech codes across the country. Their website is just very impressive on that. And it's pretty scary to see how many of them survive in various forms around the country. If they were pursued in court, I think they'd go down. Both I and the AUP are opposed to speech codes. I also think that hostile environment complaints can be quite facetious and very dangerous and can limit freedom of speech on campus, and that they're often terribly misused, and that we should, you know, resist speech codes throughout the academy, and that we should dismiss fatuous hostile environment complaints very quickly. One of the things we encounter is just gratuitous hostile environment complaints that are pursued for 6 or 9 months, and people are subjected to a kind of, you know, slow torture while a groundless hostile environment complaint is pursued through a university process. So I think a lot of work needs to be done to sort of abandon the politically correct imperative that leads hostile environment complaints to be used against people over and over again. Where I disagree with Stanley a bit is on the application of academic freedom to students. Let's use a parallel analogy. Faculty members can pursue intellectual inquiries in whatever direction they want to. They can follow their hearts and their heads with an intellectual project. But that doesn't protect them from the judgment of their peers about whether that intellectual project is worth anything. They come up for tenure. They submit things to journals for publication. So you have the freedom to take an idea anywhere you want, but you can face professional consequences if you've done it badly. And students also have the freedom to pursue their inquiries wherever it leads them, but they also face professional judgments. First of all, they face them from their teachers in a course. If they're doctoral students, they face them when they're submitting a dissertation. So, you know, they can do as they wish, but they're not free of judgments about the value of what they've done. And in that sense, students and faculty members have parallel practical constraints on their ability to exercise academic freedom in an absolute way.
I'm not against speech codes. I'm just saying speech codes as a legal issue are dead. I'd be happy with a speech code if I wrote it. With respect to students, two dark days in my mind. One I witnessed in 1965 at the University of California at Berkeley were the first Slate supplement, Student Evaluation of Teachers, was published, and later was used as a basis for tenure discussion, although my pious colleagues assured me that that could never happen. The second and worst days is when departments invited students to become members of any committee, but especially personnel committees. What are you doing, giving away your shop? It's nutty.
All right, well, we may pick up on some of those issues in the question and answer period. Let me just follow up on another point that came up that had to do with changing concepts of academic freedom in relation to new technology. It seems to me that one of the central issues here that turns out to be a source of ambiguity is the definition of the classroom. No one seems to have problems with the idea that a professor could go downtown and make a speech, participate in a political campaign, write an op-ed piece, but the question is what happens when that comes into the classroom. And today, the definition of the classroom is not as simple as it was before, partly because of websites, of email, of various kinds of teacher-student communications, of Facebook. And indeed, part of the ambiguity of the case that the two of you have mentioned was that the material in question was not on the syllabus, it wasn't in the class, but it was something sent by the professor to the students, and there was a question raised whether or not that was part of the class, as it were. So I'm wondering if either of you have comments about how one defines the classroom, which is the sphere of academic freedom that we're concerned with.
It's easy for me, perhaps too easy. The classroom for me needn't be a physical space. It can be an internet space. It is the place where what I call academicizing goes on. Wherever that is, that's where the classroom is. And sometimes it will have the apparatus of a university structure with rewards and punishment, and sometimes it will not. So it doesn't matter to me whether the materials come in through the internet or are brought in and in hard copies brought in hard copies by the professor. Again, it's just a question of what is going on in the space of this activity. Is it an academic interrogation or is it something else? Give the same kind of answer to the question of what kinds of materials can be brought into what classes. Any kinds of material can be brought into any class, so long as there is a connection and a plausible and good pedagogical connection made between those materials and the subject matter of the course. When I teach, the other day, when I was teaching realist and formalist jurisprudence to my law school students, the key moment was when I introduced to them Andrew Marvell's Mower Against the Gardens, and it really worked. But I knew what I was doing. It was a pedagogical moment. I wasn't departing from my emphasis on legal interpretation and its disputes. I was bringing in another perspective which illuminated it. We are good at that, and we should be allowed to do that, and no one should tell us that certain materials cannot be brought into certain courses simply because the name of the course is such and such.
Yeah, I and the AUP have taken that position repeatedly, and I think we do so in part in response to conservative critiques. I've debated David Horowitz a number of times, where the model is whatever the catalog says the course is about, that's the full range of reference that you can make. And what the AUP's tried to argue is that that is an absurd and really frightful constraint on the way the human mind works, which makes connections. It sees contrasts. It sees similarities and differences. And often in a pedagogical situation, those kinds of comparisons, which can traverse historical periods, they can move from discipline to discipline, they're unpredictable. They come to mind in the sort of lightning moments of the classroom, and nothing should restrict them. And I think that's, part of what's at stake, as I'm agreeing with Stanley, is how the human mind functions, and one doesn't want to repress it in a pedagogical situation. That said, the question that you brought up, that is what kind of space the classroom is, I think, under some real threats. In 1915, the AUP argued that the classroom was a fundamentally private space, that it is in many ways a protected space, that it shouldn't be fully exposed to public view, that the classroom shouldn't be available for public debate. But in truth, if a student can take his or her iPhone and record some of what goes on in the classroom, pop it up on a computer, edit it in any way he or she wants, and put it up on YouTube in a matter of minutes, a lot of what we have taken to be private classroom events and private classroom discourse is going to be available, often in distorted forms, for public critique and commentary and engagement. And thus, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult to protect the private character of the classroom as technology evolves. And I actually warned the AUP about a year ago that videos taken surreptitiously in classrooms were going to start appearing on YouTube, and we had reason to be very concerned about it. It's another case where I think we're going to have to write rules and write policy statements that help protect the classroom to the degree that we can. But, you know, when it's put out in the public sphere, when classroom conversation is literally disseminated across the globe, then the character of the classroom has changed, and I think we're going to have to confront that. I'm not real happy about it, but we're going to have to confront it.
I think that's right. What I do is, I, of course, this will not surprise anyone, I don't allow computers, iPads, cell phones, or anything else in my classroom. But, as Carrie indicated, that's my command. There are all kinds of ways to evade that command, which would then raise the problems that Carrie has instanced.
Stanley, I can show you a fountain pen, which is, in fact, an audio and video recorder. It looks exactly like a fountain pen, but it can record an hour and a half of classroom conversation, and you can pop it up on your computer and edit it. So, yeah. I mean,
it's probably an AK-47, too.
Might be.
My question is directed to Stanley Fish. Based on the way in which you describe the limits of the academic side, and I tend to agree largely with you that people derive their freedom from their academic expertise, but to put this in the context in which the Bill Robinson, you know, I was slightly involved in the Bill Robinson case, and I would simply say I came down entirely, I'm concurring with what Carrie Nelson had said. But here's the question. I come to UCSB as a professor 2001. I'm one of, I come as a bona fide Israel-Palestine expert. I mean, my expertise is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. At UCSB, I don't know how many professors we have, but I'm like one of a handful. But, you know, on this campus that actually have research, writing, and serious academic credentials. So by your sentiment, it would seem that only me and maybe three or four of my colleagues should even be allowed or encouraged to talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
No, that's wrong.
Okay. But I would just say that I think that, you know, in some ways and about many areas, while people shouldn't purport to have an expertise they don't have, even for both the professors and students, the learning process about something as complicated and as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and about which very few people have serious expertise, I think in some ways that's a, you know, a question.
Look, it's not a question of the expertise, and I'm going to be more severe on you than your question implied that I might be, because even though you're an expert on the subject, and the question is, and how then in your classroom do you deploy your expertise? Presumably you're not only an expert on the subject, by that I mean its history, the many complexities of the situation, the many possibilities that may or may not develop in the future, but presumably you also have views on what has been done, views of approval and disapproval, on what has been done, and strong views perhaps on what should be done and what shouldn't be done. Those should not get into your classroom at all. When I leave a class, at the end of the class, most class I most recently taught was a class in the First Amendment, and there's no more contested area than the First Amendment. But at the end of the semester, once again, my students came up to me and said, but we don't know where you stood on any of the issues that arose in all of those cases. And that makes me extremely happy, because that's not what I'm there for, to tell them where I stand or where I think they should stand. What I'm there for is to take a complex body of materials, either the First Amendment or the Middle East situation, and lay out its structure, its history, its comparisons to other moments in history, and so forth. That's my job, and that's my recommendation to all of you. Teach, it's kind of like a Kantian categorical imperative, teach so that no one at the end of the course knows where you stand, unless the matter at hand is entirely academic. I'm a Miltonist in addition to being a law professor. The big debate in Milton, since, it's wonderful, it started in 1712 with Addison, and it's still going strong. Is Satan the hero of Paradise Lost? I'm here to tell you absolutely that the answer is no. And in my classes, I teach that answer. That is, I don't say, well, some people say, and then other people say, and a third person says. I say, no, he's not, and for the following reasons. Why? Because what is that dispute in that classroom is an academic interpretive matter. That's not the same kind of thing as my saying in, let's say, a class on the First Amendment, in my First Amendment class, that there should or should not be laws against pornography. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to let my students know where I stand on that, although I am going to try to make sure that they understand the intricacies of all the case law that has centered around a subject like pornography.
Let me try and draw a simple distinction that I think might help clarify the difference between us. I think Stanley has every right, and I would protect his right, to make just the kind of statements that he said, that people should not intrude their personal views in the classroom. I regard that as a kind of personal ethic. I regard that as Stanley's teaching philosophy. He has, not only does he have a right to have it, but he has a right to try to persuade other people to adopt it. He has a right to advocate for the absence of advocacy in the classroom. That's what he's doing. He's advocating for the absence of advocacy, and I think it's a good thing to have that as part of the university environment. There are faculty members who teach for decades, and at the end of their careers, they proudly say, none of my students know where I stand on any political issue whatsoever. And I think they have every right to that position, and they have every right not just to adopt it personally, but to promote it as an ethic and a philosophy on campus. Where I would draw the line, however, is with Stanley's earlier ejaculation that he would fire Bill Robinson in 10 seconds. In other words, what I and the AEUP object to is the attempt to impose that individual teaching philosophy on others and the effort to penalize them if they diverge from that teaching philosophy.
I don't regard it as a teaching philosophy. I regard it as a definition of academic work. Either academic work is distinctive, that is something that is not like other work, political work, therapeutic work, parental work, parishional work, the work of preaching. Either it's a distinctive activity or it has no right to be at the table. And you have to decide what is distinctive about academic work. And what is distinctive about academic work is taking the academic stance as defined by Newman, by Weber, by Harry Calvin in the 1967 statement for the University of Chicago, and even by Jacques Derrida, who said, beware of ends, by which he meant, teaching is not about moving people toward ends. Teaching is about opening up materials to the academic gaze. I'm not offering that as a philosophy of teaching. I'm saying that that is what teaching should be by definition. By definition.
Look, Derrida has essays that speak out against slavery, that speak out against nuclear war, that speak out against racism. So his work is not value neutral.
I'm talking about his teaching.
Even in the deconstructive process. But you know, setting Derrida aside, there are a lot of things that are special about the academic tradition. It should embody a sense of history. It should embody carefully researched analysis. It should embody the marshaling of evidence to support claims and to support positions. There are a whole series of things that are distinctive about academic work compared to the kinds of advocacy that take place in the public sphere. So, you know, it's not that academic work doesn't include some distinctive features, I think that it does. Where we differ is that it's not an absolute, self-contained, separate category, but that it in fact embraces some of those other social roles and some of those other forms of debate and participation in social life.
I have a question for both of you based on the, a question about disciplinariness and disciplines. Professor Fish opened your debate tonight with the creation of a new discipline, that is the discipline of academic freedom. And Professor Nelson also made a point and a reference to the limits to academic freedom being judged by the standards of disciplines. Now, we live in a society today and in an academic sphere today that is very, very pluralistic, in so much as we have interdisciplinary disciplines. And I'd like to draw your attention to another case tonight, and that's the case of Arizona with the shooting, the removal of a particular discipline, that is Mexican-American studies. My question to both of you is, how do you address academic freedom when it comes to the interest of groups rather than just simply individuals? Because most of your conversation tonight has been on Bill Robinson, the position of a student or a professor, but what about academic freedom for communities that have not been able to have that space to engage in conversations about their lives, that being ethnic studies and other interdisciplinary studies? Thank you.
Yeah, I've written about the case in Arizona, and my position was as follows, that insofar as ethnic studies is what it says it is by its title, that is the study of ethnic traditions, literatures, communities, philosophies, music, art, and so forth, it is a perfectly respectable subject. The objection brought to the ethnic studies programs, or some of them in Arizona, was that they were precisely political in that they were teaching not the academic academic investigation and analysis of ethnic materials, but were teaching ethnic pride or ethnic solidarity ethnic political unity. Now, if that was true, then I have to agree with the Arizona legislature that there's something wrong there, that they shouldn't be doing it. Ethnic studies is one of a number of studies starting, I suppose, in the modern era with women's studies, but including gay and lesbian studies, black studies, Native American studies, Latino studies. What characterizes all of these groups is that they made their way into the academy through a program of political activism. It was political activism that got the people interested, the groups interested in having those studies in colleges and universities successful, made them successful. And as I said to a group of a newly formed group of Native American studies faculty and students at the University of Illinois at Chicago when I was dean, you got here as activists. Now forget about it. Because your activism was designed to get you into the academic room. Now that you're in the academic room, perform as academics. Not only because, at least in my view, that is philosophically and morally your obligation, but because if you don't, you will receive no respect from your fellow academics at all.
Well, I think the problem is not whether they're going to receive any respect. The problem is whether they're going to get tenure if Stanley's the dean.
Yes, they will. I have a very good record on that.
That might be the greater risk. I mean, look, the questioner actually raised several issues. The first one that she talked about was the relationship between the kinds of intellectual limits that operate on faculty members if they're in a clear, single, well-defined discipline versus if they're working in interdisciplinary areas. And I think that's a really serious challenge to how we adjudicate academic issues. The Churchill case was partly a case where he's operating in multiple disciplines and where the constraints and expectations of some of those component disciplines conflicted with his practices. It should have been resolved by bringing people to bear on the case who shared his interdisciplinary commitments, and the mix of disciplinary commitments should have been the determining factor. I think that's an extremely clear case where interdisciplinarity or multidisciplinarity can present huge problems for academic judgments. But that set aside, then the next question is, what happens to disciplines that grow out of social movements? And Stanley is quite right that there's been a clear migration of the impulses of social movements into the creation of individual academic disciplines or sometimes interdisciplinary areas. I, of course, don't think you can mandate that those people leave their political and social agendas behind. At the same time, in the early incarnation of some socially motivated academic areas within the university, the political passions were much greater than they evolved over a period of a decade or so. So you sort of watch some of these disciplines arriving out of social movements in their first university incarnations being pretty ruthlessly and, I think, sometimes repressively political, not tolerant of divergent point of views with very narrow political agendas. But over time, they do tend to become more academic. But the demand that they simply abandon those social commitments entirely, I think, is an illicit one and one that, you know, that basically sort of breaks the hearts of the people involved. But I did see excesses in the early stages of their, of shall we say, their academicization, to borrow Stanley's rhetoric.
All right, of course, when they get to that stage, and you're quite right, when they become what I would say mature and become academics, they're then accused of having copped out.
I liked that you began with an overview that looks at different concepts of academic freedom that really says there's a study to be done here, and I liked that your statement about the fact that it needs to be a nuanced discussion. It's not an absolute. It begs the question, which I wanted to pose, in a sense, whose nuance is being gored? You wear two hats as the president of the AAUP, a professor, a thinking person with a view, and the head of a guild, in effect. Mm-hmm. And you have an interest, as the guild president, as it were, in representing professors who you've argued are the sole province of what academic of who should experience academic freedom. But it doesn't necessarily mean that academic freedom only represents, only serves the professors, it serves the whole, the greater community. To crib from my friend Arthur Gross Schaefer's recent paper, there's a concept of stakeholders, and there are stakeholders besides professors, and I'd like to ask you to comment on how your views of academic freedom can encompass some of the other stakeholders. For example, I'll be brief, I'm talking too much. Students, you mentioned briefly at some point, students certainly are capable of criticizing their professors and standing up to them. Problem is, in Robinson, what I noticed was the two students who were involved, my understanding was they were actually not comfortable speaking up. They were intimidated, they were scared, and in a forum on academic freedom, I saw some kids speaking brought to tears, which suggests maybe students aren't, they do need something in this equation. How do you encompass that? And the other critical thing I'd like you to talk about there is when you talked about Professor Fish, you talked about pedagogic groundings. Things have to meet a certain pedagogic standard. One of the things that's very tough to talk about in this discussion is pedagogic review. And how can we deal with that in the equation? Review. How can we deal with, for example, forget the question of was Robinson speaking outside of the class or within the purview of his class. Let's say somebody wanted to assert, for example, that he was academically inferior. Hypothetically, how do we have room to discuss that? Is there a means of examining whether he's? Is there a means to examine whether a professor is functioning pedagogically in a way that upholds the student's academic interest?
Sure. There used to be a system in which I grew up, and I presume that Kerry, because we're both men of a certain age by now, grew up, in which there was peer visitation, or rather non-peer visitation. I distinctly remember when I was the last instructor in the University of California at Berkeley campus. That is, they abolished the rank of instructor the year after I became one. No cause and effect here. It was in the works for a long time. But while I was an instructor and a young assistant professor, my classes were regularly visited by senior professors who would observe, take notes, and write reports. And that seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable thing to do and has every advantage over student evaluations for reasons that I could go on listing forever. So I think that review by senior faculty, which then make their way into the process, I think that's the way to do it. Not students and not university tribunals.
Carrie, did you want to
comment? Let me just plug a statement that the AAUP issued in 1967, which I still think is the best single statement on student rights that's around. We're very proud of it. It lays out students' own freedoms, I think, in a very clear and persuasive way. You know, I can't judge what impact Robinson had on his students. I just don't have the information to really know that in the way that I would want to if I wanted to comment on it. But I will say that faculty members have a responsibility if they feel that some of their colleagues are imposing their views on their students as opposed to exposing their views to their students. They should intervene. I mean, they should put pressure on those faculty members to give their students freedom of intellectual expression and development in their classrooms. I mean, you need to develop an ethic that welcomes student disagreement. I mean, I sometimes, and many instructors do this, I sometimes take up positions in a classroom which I actually absolutely do not believe in just to see if I can get my students worked up and arguing with me. And I think that's, you know, a classroom is much healthier if there's free disagreement and debate. For one thing, the students do some of the work for you if they're arguing with you. I mean, they make the classroom what it is. So I think, you know, for me, it is an absolute ethical necessity that students be free to express their own views and not have the views of faculty members imposed on them.
All right,
that has to be enforced and promoted by the community, most obviously by the departmental community in large departments.
So I have two related questions. One, and you raised it earlier, but I don't think either of you addressed it explicitly. Do students have the right not to be offended? And then the second question is, in terms of pedagogical review, what measures can be taken to make that an effective and efficient process besides senior faculty giving their best estimation based on sort of an outsider's perspective? I mean, would senior faculty members have to be attending classes regularly and taking notes? Would video cameras have to be set up? And then I think this raises the issue of, you know, like the Schrodinger's cat, is that, you know, once you start observing something, you're changing it. And, you know, would that be a problem?
All right. Well, I can respond immediately to one point. You asked, do students have a right not to be offended? And my answer is absolutely no. Students need to be offended. They need to be challenged. They need to be sufficiently challenged so that they will either rethink their perspectives or that they'll learn how to defend them. They'll learn how to marshal the evidence to defend them. I think it's absolutely essential part of higher education that students be outraged from time to time, that they be upset by what they're exposed to. That's the intellectual life puts you through that kind of process, and universities should encourage it, not protect students from it. So on that, I think my position would be clear. One of the nuances of peer review, which was your other subject, has to do with the hierarchical structure of the teaching force, which has become more and more prevalent in the academy. It's a real problem, I think, when, you know, say part-time instructors are reviewed by senior faculty with tenure. The notion of peer review, I think, in a pedagogical situation especially, needs to embrace review by people of similar status and experience.
Just as a point of information, our review of teaching in the University of California is multifaceted. It includes student evaluations, both written and numerical, but it also allows faculty to submit syllabi and course materials, and there are a whole variety of ways in which somebody's classroom experience can be evaluated.
When I write a column every week for the New York Times, and obviously some columns draw more response than others. Two columns I wrote about the evils of student evaluation drew huge responses, mostly from teachers and a significant number from teachers who had left the profession because of the culture of student evaluation, and a significant number of students who confessed that they were disgusted by the way their student colleagues used the student evaluation system. Student evaluations are a bad thing. There is nothing to be said for them.
So my question is a little bit more on the impact that and the authority that academic figures command in the public sphere. And you know, I think that's a huge part of this academic freedom debate. I'm reminded of an instance where a professor was removed from tenure for advocating creationism or intelligent design, if you will. You know, that wasn't really his area of expertise, but in the public sphere he was advocating it anyway, and I was wondering what your particular stances are, you know, in a situation like that, and in just the authority that, you know, irregardless of expertise, an academic can command in the public sphere.
Well, if he was, I don't know the case you're talking about, but if he was disciplined for advocating intelligent design outside of the academic context, then he should not have been disciplined. If he were advocating intelligent design in any classroom, I, of course, would not have approved it, but I would certainly approve his discussing and analyzing intelligent design, which is a real subject with a real history, and there are many important aspects of it that should be studied. As for the question you began with, the command that academic figures have on the public, well, there used to be a golden age when that might be said to be true, and the academic figures who had a command on the public attention were most often the presidents or leaders of important institutions like the University of California, Harvard, University of Michigan, Princeton, Columbia. There was a time, this sounds so nostalgic, but it is nostalgia that I'm expressing, there was a time when university presidents occupied a position that allowed them to speak to legislators, to senators, and even to presidents in ways that carried a great deal of force, not only moral force, but practical force. There is a tale, perhaps apocryphal, about a president of Harvard University who was urged by some of his friends and colleagues to run for the presidency of the United States, and his reply was, "Why should I step down in office?"
The question raises a really complex and I think very difficult issue, which is what, and the area where the difficulty is greatest is, what if a faculty member makes statements in the public sphere, in a newspaper, in the town square, wherever, that suggest he's incompetent in his or her discipline? Let's say a paleontologist goes to a church and makes a talk, offers a talk and says that the fossil record is a fake. The fossil record was put there by God to test our faith, which is one of the arguments one encounters. If for a paleontologist to make that argument, doesn't matter whether it's made in the university or whether it's made elsewhere, it does bear on one's confidence in his or her professional expertise. I think it's fair to say that, you know, the academic conviction is on the side that the fossil record is real, that it's not simply an artifact to test human faith. Or let's say that an evolutionary biologist in the public sphere advocates intelligent design. Those are moments when the public statements actually call into question the professional competence of the faculty member, and they could be subjected to an academic hearing. In other words, they could be his or her colleagues could question: have they made similar assertions in the classroom? Have they argued, advocated for what are fundamentally taken to be unscientific or irrational positions in a university setting? So, other than that, you know, if a literature professor argues in the town square that the fossil record is a fake, he or she is protected by academic freedom. Or if a history professor does the same thing, the classic example that the AAUP uses is of a Northwestern University professor, Arthur Butts, who has argued that the Holocaust never happened. He's an engineer. He's never said that in any of his classes, in part because the classes have nothing to do with the Holocaust. I assume they have to do with building bridges. So he avoids making those statements on campus. Plus, it doesn't question his professional expertise as an engineer to make those claims that the Holocaust doesn't exist. He's actually written a book about it. So we say he's protected by academic freedom because those statements, although we think they're historically wrong, don't bear on his professional competence.
It is one of the few times in which I'm going to pronounce on more expansively on academic freedom than Carey, because I think the example, at least one of the examples he used, of the paleontologist or evolutionary biologist who gets up in his church or in some other public space and says that, in fact, he doesn't believe any of this stuff in his heart, I don't think that that has any bearing on his professional competence, because he can go into the classroom and use the skills and knowledge that were given to him by his training in paleontology or in evolutionary biology and do an absolutely fine job. I don't think that the test of whether you should be in the classroom should be the sincerity, the deep sincerity and belief, your deep commitment to the perspective or disciplinary protocols within which you work. And I see no reason. I see no reason.
Right. I want to...
Stanley, just let me clarify. I did say that a person in that situation could be subjected to an academic hearing to determine whether they advocated those same ideas in the classroom.
That would be a different matter.
That's the issue.
Okay.
As a Hillel rabbi at USC, UCSB here, Loyola Marymount, where I teach, students have been hurt. They've been made the butt of jokes, or they've been harassed by professors, and they've gone to other faculty who have not helped them. So the fact that you think that faculty and others are there to balance the equation with a strong faculty who's abusing their position, I've not seen that happen. But I have three cases that I've been involved in. I'd be curious what your sense would be on academic freedom. Case one, make it very clear, a engineering professor in his classroom takes a very strong position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Doesn't matter which side. Would that be appropriate?
No.
Number one. Number two, I know your position, Stan. I'm not sure, because Carey has, I'm not,
well,
I'll make sure.
Let me answer that question this way. The AAUP allows for occasional intrusions of irrelevant material into the classroom. What we defend strongly is the ability for faculty members to draw connections across history, across disciplines, but we also think sometimes things happen in the world that justify people moving away from the class subject towards something else. I mean, the obvious example, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, do classes the next day ignore that, or do they talk about it? I actually did run into a member, an elderly member of the National Association of Scholars, who said that her philosophy class met the day after Pearl Harbor, and she's still proud that they didn't mention it. Well, a lot of classes the day after Pearl Harbor did mention it, just as classes the day after Martin Luther King's assassination or Kennedy's assassination or September 11th. Sometimes events like that justify setting aside the class and just dealing with something that's powerful and necessary for people to discuss. So, you know, a test might be, are events in the Middle East of such dramatic character on a given moment that you can leave the topic of engineering and talk about that briefly?
But go to church.
Wait, Carrie, you're very good. Let me make it very, very clear. I just want to make sure that there's a clear answer here. There's no event in the Middle East. It's his own personal agenda that he's done for years. Tell me very clearly, it's not Pearl Harbor, it's not 9/11, mm-hmm. it's not a particular event, but he brings it up every year in his classroom, every class. I'm sorry, every semester. Well?
Then it falls into a category of persistently intruding irrelevant material, and it's a problem.
Okay, second case, I'll do this very quickly. A student is applying to UCSB. He is a former IDF soldier. He is told by the chair of the Middle East Studies Department, when you're in my classroom, I do not want you to bring up your experience. It's irrelevant because I'm going to teach what I believe is correct.
He was a what?
A former Israeli soldier.
Israeli Defense Force. But what's the class that's at stake?
Middle East Studies.
Ah. No, I think the student has the academic freedom to bring up his experience if he sees it as relevant to the class material. I mean, students have to have the same right to think freely in the classroom, to make connections, to bring to bear on the subject matter what they feel is relevant to the subject matter. Faculty and students have to share that academic freedom. So I think the rejection, the idea that he can't bring up his IDF experience, is unacceptable.
And then the last one, a professor at a UC who tells their students, we have someone coming to speak on campus. That person should not be allowed to speak because what they're going to say to you is wrong and false.
Prohibition of any speaker who is invited by a bona fide campus group is completely unacceptable.
Okay, thank you.
That's right.
This is in relation to something Professor Fish said earlier about taking... about not taking positions on politically sensitive subject matter in his courses. And I guess I just question whether or not that's even possible. I think the example...
It's easy.
I think the... Well, hold on. I'm not so sure, and I'd like to hear what Professor Carey says. I think the examples you use are if you're teaching on the First Amendment or the Holocaust, and it strikes me that by the time that you've designed a syllabus, selected your readings, written lectures, that no matter how much care you've put into it, what you present is not going to be anywhere near as politically sterile as you claim it is.
Sterile is your word, and it's offensive.
Or neutral. Okay, so
neutral
politically
is a word.
Neutral.
Neutral is
so,
a word okay, I never use. Neutral is the wrong word, because neutral suggests that you're occupying an equipoise of some kind between two positions. You shouldn't be in the neighborhood of the positions. You shouldn't be within sighting this. Now, as to the question of selection, that's a real question. But don't be so happy that you've posed it.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can I have one more part to the question?
No.
Okay.
No. The question of selection is a real question, because it goes to the genuine point that even the process of selection necessarily is a process of exclusion and inclusion, which is necessarily a statement by the professor that he or she values some things over some other things. That's not only okay, but it's inevitable so long as the things that are valued are academic things. When I, in my classes on Milton, only emphasize a theological perspective, it's because of my conviction that theology is the way to understand what's going on in Milton's poetry. When I choose one First Amendment casebook over another, it's because I think that the cases that are included in one are more representative than in another. Those are all academic selection processes. One might then say, but even by becoming a scholar of Renaissance literature or of the First Amendment, rather than becoming a scholar, let's say, of Native American literature or of tort law, you've already made a decision. Okay, at that level, what you're saying, and I hate this phrase beyond any other, is that everything is political. No more banal statement has ever been made on the face of the earth. Because it is, and know why it's banal? Because it's true. And it's true because, but it's trivially true. All it means is that in any organized form of work, there are alternative ways of doing things and alternative selections that you can make of materials and approaches. If it's the case that you are performing a political act when you decide to teach the Great Gatsby instead of Beloved in an American literature course, then you've taken the word political and expanded so that it has no meaning whatsoever. It's just a trick. Don't fall for it.
Well, I think the questioner raises several issues. First of all, part of what he was suggesting, that it is possible for people, either wittingly or unwittingly, to telegraph some of their political beliefs. And I think that does happen. Even no matter how rigorously some people try to suppress their points of view, often they are telegraphed. And so the process is not as clean and as absolute for many of us as some perhaps would like it to be. I also certainly believe that politics permeates social life, and that it also permeates the social life of the classroom, and that it cannot really be excluded. And I think there's real value in thinking through a broader notion of politics and how it shapes some of the decisions we make and how it shapes some of the rhetoric that we use. So I'm open to a much broader definition of what counts as politics and what has political import than perhaps Stanley is.
All right. We don't have time for any more speeches, but do either of you have any closing comments or final words you'd like to offer?
I'll just say I think Carrie did great.
Carrie?
I think that the main thing I want to say is that I am very troubled by the fact that for the past 2 hours, I've actually sort of felt that I've been in Santa Barbara. And, you know, I need some therapy to work through how that could possibly be the case.
Well, the invitation is still open to you, and we realize it's the middle of the night for you almost. So this has been a really interesting conversation, and I think it's been a great instance of the tradition of the Roop debate, because it's modeled what a really interesting debate and discussion can be. So thank you all for coming and for your attention, and thanks to our speakers.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.